The Forgotten Soldier, Disc 5.
Chapter 30. Turning to Creed, I said, "Does that help?" He whirled to the keyboard and said, "As a matter of fact, it does. Pandora sends location information every damn time you use it. It's evil shit, but it works for us. I'll have to find his username, then crack his password. But with the information we have on him, it shouldn't be that hard." Through a Department of Defense database, he pulled up everything we had on Guy's brother, including email accounts, AKO login, and anything else the DOD required of its soldiers. Then used that to mine the web for associated usernames, hoping that he, like most people, duplicated passwords and login credentials. At the same time, he started a devious little program that began a brute force attack against the Pandora login, throwing everything he found at it. He started his work digging deeper and deeper, and I turned to Kurt. "Sir, what's the real mission here? I understand bring him home, but what if he's actually onto something? What if he's fighting the good fight?" Kurt closed his eyes for a moment, then said, "Just get him home. Whatever he's doing, it's not right. We can't have individual justice. If he's correct on the death of his brother, we'll deal with it. But he can't do that unilaterally." I took that in, considering just saying roger that and driving on with the mission. But I couldn't. I said, "Sir, he's got a lot of information on the guys from Qatar. My mission in the Caymans wasn't smoke and mirrors. I get he might be off the reservation, but they did kill his brother. They deserve to be put down. It's a task force mission." Kurt bristled and said, "Pike, don't go there. Don't. Just get him back. I can't throw away." I waited, but he didn't finish. I said, "Can't throw what away? This unit, seriously? Is that what we've become? More worried about our own asses than what's in front of us? Sir, Pike, leave it alone." He ran his fingers through his hair and said, "Fuck, this is getting way out of control." I said, "Nothing is out of control. You control your own destiny, and what's right is right." He rubbed his eyes, and I saw the absolute pain of what Guy was doing. What I had done in the past. He said, "You have no idea what you represent. You are an organization that is antithetical to everything the United States represents. You do what you can for the good of the nation, but you represent the worst. We have more power than any element in the United States arsenal, and every bit of that power is predicated on secrecy. We fight the good fight, but Guy has become the bad. I'll burn down the organization before I'll take the bad." The statement was so harsh, I wasn't sure where to go with it. I said, "Sir, surely you don't think..." Creed cut me off, saying, "I've got penetration. I've got the Pandora account. It was used mainly at Fort Meade for the last 3 months." I heard the location and immediately thought of my own deployments, when I wasn't as top secret as I was now. Keeping my eyes on Kurt, I said, "That's the satellite dish from Afghanistan. The IP address reroutes to Fort Meade. Go later. What do you have?" Creed said, "I got a trace here in D.C. The latest trace as of yesterday is Athens, Greece. Before that..." Creed didn't want to say it. I looked at him, knowing it would be bad. "Before that, what?" "Before that, the login was from Key West, Florida." The words sank into the room like a dismal fog. Kurt said, "Shit. He's gone over." I now knew we had to make a choice. It wasn't just me talking a man off the ledge anymore. I said, "Sir, what do you want me to do? Bring him home. And if I can't, what are my rules of engagement? He's going after all of them, and he's going to find them." Kurt paused, then said, "End it. One way or the other. There is more riding on this than just a single man." I saw Jennifer fold inward, looking like she felt sick. I said, "Sir, I don't know if I can do that. I'm telling you up front, you're asking me to kill an American soldier." He bristled, saying, "I never said that. Never, Jesus. I'd never ask you to do that. I'm asking you to solve the problem." I faced him head on, looking him in the eye. "Sir, you know where this is going. I'll bring him back if I can, but you picked me for a reason. I know where his mind is. I know what he's capable of. And he's going to do it. He's going to kill every single damn one of those guys from Qatar, unless I stop him. And I can't promise how that will occur. Kurt said nothing. Just stared at the wall, feeling the disaster, and knowing he was the commander, the one to give the order. Finally, he said, "Pike, I can't let it happen. Even if it's right in your mind, I need you to interdict him, period. Can you do that?" I glanced at Jennifer, seeing revulsion floating in her expression. Next to her, Nicholas Seacrest showed confusion, not sure what he was being asked to volunteer for. I said, "Yeah, I can do it." Kurt relaxed and said, "Thank you. Look, bring him home. I don't want any killing. Of the Qatar guys or him. You're the only one who can do that." Repeating a quote by the assassin from In the Line of Fire, I said, "Because we can't have monsters roaming the quiet countryside now, can we?"
Chapter 31. Brushing his teeth inside his hotel room, washing away the grime from 48 hours eating junk food, Guy heard his phone buzz. A three-phased, jarring vibration, it was distinct, telling him the GPS fence had been broken. He was surprised, pulling the toothbrush from his mouth. Not because it had triggered, but because of the time. It was going on 6 p.m., and the target had only been back at the yacht for a couple of hours. Guy still had preparations to make, but the alarm caught him short, making him wish yet again that he had a team, someone to track the man 24/7, a group of operators that he could insert in and out, instead of just him, trying to maintain a blanket on the target. After escaping from Nikos's thugs, he'd taken a commercial flight straight to Heraklion, Crete, getting out of the furnace of Athens. It was an overnight sail on a routine ferry, but only 40 minutes by air. He knew two simple facts. One, his target was meeting a man on the island, and two, he was taking another yacht to get here. Not knowing where the meeting was to occur, or even when, he'd conducted a stakeout of the Heraklion harbor. In truth, the boat could have docked anywhere, involving a 360-degree search of every cove. It was an island, after all. But Guy had heard Heraklion mentioned, and figured a boat that size would not port at a simple harbor with nothing but a slip of concrete to moor against. No, it would anchor at a habitual place, somewhere with electrical power and other amenities. Every coastal city in Crete had one, but Guy was betting it would be Heraklion Harbor, the one for the island's capital. He knew it was guesswork, but it was a fairly good one. Even given that guess, the surveillance hadn't been easy. He had initially focused his reconnaissance effort on a location that would allow him to continually observe the slips. There was none. The harbor, like most harbors, jutted out from the city itself, surrounded by a seawall, without any place to camp out and watch. He'd hoped for a hotel overlooking the slips, but was out of luck. The closest he could find being a mid-priced hotel called the GDM Megaron, which had a view of the sea but certainly wouldn't work for surveillance. It did get him close enough to react if the boat ever arrived, though, so he made it his temporary tactical operations center. In Athens, he'd purchased and downloaded a unique Android app that let him access thousands of open-source webcams around the world, from zoos to traffic cameras. It was a time-wasting way for the average user to gaze across the continent at a beach they would never visit. But it had a double use as a poor man's surveillance application. Guy had used it to search for cameras in the Heraklion harbor. He'd found one way out on the seawall, watching the entrance to the harbor and the large ferry lines that came and went, but none of the boat slips themselves. The only thing this harbor had that others didn't was an ancient castle, sitting out in the water on the seawall about 200 meters out, protecting the harbor from intruders who were no longer relevant. It was an archaeological treasure, famed for its history, and not something he could use for the long term. But he could use it for pinpoint mechanics once the yacht entered. He decided to split the difference, leveraging the webcam app to identify the Qatari vessel arriving, then the fortress for the start of a pattern of life. From there, he would, hopefully, inject the target's phone with another application called the One Spy, which would allow him to covertly monitor the target both for cell phone content and location, freeing him up from close-in surveillance. The castle itself was something from the 7th century and was connected to the land by a concrete walkway along the top of the seawall. He'd investigated and saw it was being renovated, with the backside blanketed in scaffolding and signs proclaiming construction hazards. But he saw nobody working. It looked like they'd run out of steam and had just left the scaffolding in place. Easy to climb, and because of the renovations, it was closed to tourists for the foreseeable future, especially with the horror show of the Greek economy. He'd purchased a hindsight survival package of olives, salami, and water, then sat on his hotel bed, alternately watching the feed on his laptop and the BBC channel on the television. Living on room service, refusing to shower or leave the monitor for more than a bathroom break, his enclosure beginning to take on the peculiar smell from hide sites in the past, he finally saw the boat he was waiting for. At dusk, a 100-footer flying the Jack of Cotter entered past the seawall. He'd left his room running to the harbor, the first time he'd broken the plane of the door in a day and a half. He'd watched the boat moor, taking note of the slip, and had sprinted back up, getting his surveillance package. Cloaked in the gathering gloom, the castle itself blocking the view from the harbor, he'd climbed the scaffolding lashed to the walls, reaching the rampart on the top. He laid out his kit, positioned his spotting scope, then settled in, doing the same thing he'd done in his hotel room, sitting and watching. Eventually, dawn had broken and the boat had begun to stir. He followed the crew members with his scope, then saw his target on the deck eating breakfast. He waited until the man appeared to be close to finishing, then surveyed the base of the castle. On the land side, fishermen were repairing nets and prepping their boats for the day. On the ocean side, with the exception of a couple taking an early stroll on the seawall, there was nothing. He packed his belongings and waited until they'd turned around, heading back towards the city. He slung his pack and scrambled over the side. He reached the rock walkway just as another couple rounded the corner. They looked at him curiously but continued strolling. He ignored them, moving towards the land, his eyes on the towering yacht, the biggest in the harbor. He saw a figure walking down the gangway but was too far to get a facial identification. He quickened his pace, intersecting the man at the juncture of the seawall, the gangway for the harbor funneling all right to that point. It was his target. He fell in behind and began to follow, once again letting his quarry dictate his actions, thinking through his mission. Killing a man was easy, especially if one didn't care about the future. But Guy needed to learn about the others. That's what he told himself. But it didn't really explain his quest. He wanted absolution. Needed to know what he was doing was just. Wanted to believe it, even without sanction. But the man in Key West had provided no information other than the location of Hyder. Guy had entered the bathroom in Key West with the naive belief that the man would tell him what he needed to know. The man had not. He had fought like a demon until the bathroom was bathed in blood. And Guy had learned only one thing, the location of Hyder. He'd left the island wondering if he'd murdered an innocent man. Not a small thing in his mind. Guy had killed many men in his life, but all in combat, in the line of fire. This one was eating at him, growing in power, draining his ability to continue. Late at night, when the bad man came and he couldn't sleep, he told himself he wasn't a terrorist, not a murderer. He focused on his brother's face to obtain blissful sleep, and then was tortured by his dreams. He desperately wanted to prove he was in the right. That required questions, along with staying alive to pursue the answers. He followed the target most of the day, the man staying on foot for the duration. There were only three interesting stops, none involving a meeting. The first was at a car rental, one of the many dotting the city. The target spent 20 minutes inside but left without a vehicle. Guy had wanted to enter the facility and learn what had transpired, but he had yet to implant his virtual tether and was forced to follow the target. Leaving there, the Arab wandered up 25 Augusto Street, the main pedestrian thoroughfare that went through the heart of the city. He went to the second stop of interest, the Alpha Bank of Greece. Guy watched him go in, but didn't follow. He took a seat at a Starbucks on the corner, unable to escape the ubiquitous smiling green icon even here, in Crete. The target exited 12 minutes later carrying a zipped bank bag, a bank bag bulging with cash. Chapter 32. The target left the bank and wandered aimlessly up the pedestrian avenue, killing time and acting like a tourist. He passed City Hall. Guy, tracking behind, seeing youthful protesters in spray-painted bedsheets howling anti-austerity slogans. Eventually, they reached the outdoor bazaar, the smell of fish overpowering. The target circled through the fish market, ignoring the vendors hawking their catches, and entered a section dedicated to trinkets and handmade crafts, bouncing in and out of the small tourist shops. Guy read his demeanor and surmised he wasn't meeting anyone here. If he had been, he wouldn't have bothered with the rental car office. He faded into the crowds and patiently waited for the target to stop longer than 5 minutes. Eventually, the target started walking back towards the harbor, and Guy began planning how he could return to the top of the castle, feeling his mission slipping away. He needed help, but in his heart, he knew he wouldn't use such help, even if he had it. Wouldn't ask anyone to bloody their hands on his quest. A part of him wanted the man to return to his boat and relieve him of the mission, giving him an out for not completing it. Another part, slithering deep in the abyss, wanted vengeance, and the dichotomy was beginning to rip at his psyche. He decided to let fate do what it would. If the man gave him the chance, he'd take it, but if he didn't, he would fly home with his information, turning himself in, and letting the task force do what it would do. And then, fate stepped into the game. Walking down a narrow alley, forcing Guy to give him a large lead, the target disappeared from view. Guy suppressed the urge to rush forward, knowing that the target wasn't the only threat. Once the man was dead, they'd look for connections, and him running down the street, caught either on a surveillance camera or in the memory of someone looking out a window, was a sure way to halt his mission profile. He reached a narrow stairwell the target had escaped through and paused, staring into darkness in confusion, then saw a sign proclaiming the day's specials. Restaurant. The snake in the abyss twitched. Time. The target was giving him time. He went up the stairs slowly, his eyes adjusting to the gloom. He entered a large room, open-air windows and tables scattered throughout, all save one empty at the late lunch hour. The target was in the back of the room, next to an upright piano with nobody playing. A hostess seated him and he pretended to peruse the menu. He ordered an appetizer just to keep the waitress away, then pulled out his stolen gremlin. It looked enough like any tablet on the market to include a Wi-Fi capability that he had no fear using it. He asked the waitress the password for the restaurant Wi-Fi, then pretended to surf the web. In actuality, he initiated the gremlin's true purpose, the parasitic device sniffing the air for cellular signals. Four phones registered. One was his. Two were a Greek country code. The last had to be his target. He selected that number, and the device began attempting to exploit. Working through Wi-Fi, Bluetooth, and the cellular network in an effort to penetrate the targeted phone. Guy kept one eye on the device and one on his target. The man was flirting overtly with the waitress, looking like a cheesy disco boy from the 70s. Guy could only imagine the idiotic lines he was using. The waitress laughed and seemed to reciprocate, and an idea formed. Guy watched the target scribble something on a piece of paper and hand it to her. And he had his in. He would trap the man with his own sorry libido. Guy started working through a plan, thinking of hotels he'd seen away from his own, when the gremlin vibrated. It had penetration. The phone now slaved with the device. Ordinarily, this would be the point when some nefarious task force exploit would be injected. But Guy had no such thing. Luckily, the cheating spouses club the world over had engendered a lucrative business in cell phone spying, and the open market was replete with cell phone exploits. The application he'd subscribed to was called the One Spy, and it allowed him to literally take over the targeted phone like a ghost in the machine, listening to calls, seeing texts and web pages real time, and giving GPS locational data were all in its repertoire, even turning on the microphone remotely to hear conversations. And it worked in the background, unseen by the phone's owner. No doubt, should the man do any sort of forensic scan, it would be found, unlike task force applications. But he didn't need root access to deploy it, and he was fairly sure the Romeo across the room would never look. Not knowing the type of phone the man would have, he'd purchased both iOS and Android applications. He scanned the readout of the slaved phone and saw it was an Apple iPhone 6. He linked the iOS into the gremlin, and the parasite went to work. 10 minutes later, it was done. Still pretending to surf the web, Guy pulled up the OneSpy webpage and logged in. Working through the menus, he pulled up the GPS feature and found a blinking blue dot sitting on top of the building the restaurant was in. The target. He smiled. No longer would he have to keep the man in sight. He used the GPS fence feature, setting an alarm should the man leave his yacht, and relaxed, eating his appetizer as the target finished his meal. When he left, Guy made no move to follow, instead waving over the waitress. Before she could speak, he said, "The man that just left works for the same company I do, in Cotter. He doesn't know me, but I'd like to surprise him tonight. I'll give you 100 euros if you'll call him when I ask." Looking hesitant, not wanting to upset a patron, she hesitated. In broken English, she said, "I don't do that. I am not." Guy leaned back and laughed and said, "No, no, no. You misunderstand. He was trying to get a date with you, yes?" She nodded. "I just want you to call him when I ask." He peeled off a 100 euro note and held it up. "You get this now. All I want to do is surprise him with some friends from work. A simple phone call. Nothing else. He's from Cotter. He'll never expect it. But my company wants to reward him. And I promise he'll be happy." Naive, but now returning his smile, she said, "He was cute. You call him, and if you want, I'll send him back to you tomorrow, after I've surprised him. You can apologize for the trick, and he'll be flattered. She nodded, saying,
Is he rich?
Yeah, he's rich. He's on that big yacht in the harbor. Her eyes widened. Everyone near the harbor having commented on its appearance, she said,
Is he staying here long?
Guy grinned and said, Yes, he'll be here for the foreseeable future, I promise.
Chapter 33. Knuckles and I exited the Megaron Musikis metro stop and took a couple of seconds to get our bearings. He pointed north towards what looked like a concert hall and said, She told me it was just on the other side of that. We started walking, and I said, You sure she's good to go? He said, I'm sure she's trustworthy, but I don't know if she'll be any help. She was close to Decoy, and when he was killed, she became close to Guy. If he was getting any help inside Greece, she'd be the first one he'd call. Carly Ramirez was a CIA case officer currently working out of the Athens station. A few years before, Knuckles had taken Decoy to Lima, Peru, for his orientation deployment, a final check before becoming a full-fledged operator in the task force, and the thing I'd talked Kurt into letting Nick Seacrest skip. While they were there, Decoy had hooked up with Carly, against Knuckles' expressed orders, and they dated on and off with a comfortable long-distance relationship that had suited them both. I didn't push any further because I knew Knuckles had been the one who delivered the news. He was close to her as well. We'd flown out of D.C. the day before, using the last known trace of the Pandora application, an ISP in a hotel in Athens. The trace wasn't real time, only showing where the Pandora application had been used in the past, requiring us to wait until Guy decided to log into his brother's account again. In essence, it only showed where he had been after he was gone, not good enough for a tracking operation. We needed something more, a name he was using or a real-time tracking capability, and the hacking cell was working on that. Apparently, through what little digital evidence Pandora kept, Creed had determined Guy was using an HTC phone, but nothing further. The SIM card was another roadblock. It had been purchased from a vending machine at JFK International. And if I knew Guy, he'd probably bought about a dozen of them. There was one bright spot. Apparently, HTC phones used some type of evil diagnostic software called Carrier IQ. It was designed to monitor and report things like dropped calls and bad data connections for troubleshooting purposes. But Creed called it a rootkit and said it not only monitored the calls, but allowed the carrier to remotely access the complete usage of the phone, to include texts, web searches, key presses, basically anything done with the handset. Somewhere in that digital trail, we wanted to find a name, a tag, something that would allow the hacking cell to dig out the alias he was using. From there, we could start a track. First, though, Creed had to get into the phone. It was all black magic to me, but he said he could do it. In the meantime, I'd sent Jennifer, Brett, and Nick to the hotel for static surveillance. It was tedious work, rotating in and out and hoping the target showed. But it was all we had. Not wanting to go sightseeing around Athens and feeling left out because we were no good for the surveillance effort, Knuckles had come up with the idea to hit up Carly and see if Guy had made contact. He'd set up a meeting at the embassy under the auspices of just passing through, and she'd put us on the cleared visitor list. We could get on the grounds, but couldn't get past Post 1, the Marine Guard, who was the gatekeeper for the interior of the embassy. We reached the side entrance to the embassy on Petru Kokkoli Street and stated our purpose. The guard looked through a list of names, then pressed a button, letting us enter the guardhouse. Inside, it looked like a small airport, complete with X-ray machine and metal detector. We unloaded our pockets into a bin, followed by our smartphones. I pushed mine towards the X-ray, and the guard said, Sorry, camera's not allowed on the grounds with your clearance, and both of those phones have cameras. I looked at Knuckles and shrugged. What do you want us to do with them? He gave me a number, saying he'd keep them out in the guardhouse. Knuckles went through the metal detector and started to shove everything back into his pockets. The back door opened and I saw a woman enter. About 5'3", with black hair that fell just past her shoulders. She had a healthy tan, a sprinkle of freckles on her face, and a little upturned nose that was cute for no damn reason whatsoever. Knuckles' smile split his face open and he gave her a bear hug. So that must be Carly. I could see why Decoy had chased her. She was pretty attractive, in a tomboy, elfish sort of way. I walked through the detector and began putting my belt back on, waiting to be introduced. Knuckles ignored me, saying, "What happened to the red hair?" "Nobody has red hair in Greece." She turned to me and said, "This must be the infamous Nephilim Logan." I showed some surprise at her using my given name instead of my call sign. She stuck out her hand and said, "Decoy told me all about you. Don't worry. It was all good. Mostly." I grinned and shook her hand, saying, "He didn't say a damn thing to me about you. Probably afraid he'd lose your attention once you met me." She said, No, I don't think that's it. Maybe because you're not my type. I don't really date Neanderthals." Huh? I thought. I'd never even met this woman, and she was going to insult me right in the embassy? I bit back my reply, and Knuckles grinned, slapping me on the back and saying, "I told you she was a handful." Carly looked past me and said, "This is it, just you two? Where's the girl, Jennifer? I wanted to meet her." Now I was really aggravated. There was no reason for Knuckles to tell a CIA case officer the makeup of the team we had here. All she needed to know was who was coming to the embassy. Carly saw my look and said, "Don't blame Knuckles. Decoy told me all about Jennifer as well." She glanced at Knuckles and I saw a little melancholy on her face. The sarcastic facade slipped a bit, and I saw the pain leak out. She said, "We had a unique relationship. He kept asking for tips on getting Jennifer into bed, because he said we were so much alike, wanting to make me jealous. But he knew it would never work. I'm not built that way." She turned back to me and said, "Besides, he also told me he didn't stand a chance because of the mighty Pike. He really respected you, you know. And he was very impressed with Jennifer. I just wanted to meet her. Not too often you get a chance to talk to someone in the arena, dealing with the enemy and you chauvinists at the same time." She winked at me to let me know I was in on the joke. And in the span of about 15 seconds, I went from being aggravated to warming up to her. I said, "Maybe you will. It's a small world we live in." She said, "That it is. Come on." We exited the guardhouse and walked down the sidewalk, moving past a newer building before turning into a courtyard with a few scattered picnic tables. Inside the glass doors, I could see Marine Post 1. Carly took a seat and said, "As far as we go." She held out her hands for Knuckles to take and said, "I've really missed you, ever since I left DC. I never see any of you secret squirrels. Guy came through here the other day and it reminded me of the good times we used to have when I was at HQ. The only saving grace for working there. When you called, I knew you guys were doing something here." She saw us both tense up and she chuckled, saying, "Come on, Knuckles. After that crap in Lima, you know I'm not telling my boss anything. I still owe you my career." While on the orientation deployment, Knuckles and Decoy had been involved with a live hostage scenario and a terrorist group called Sendero Luminoso, and had solved the problem with Carly's help, meaning they'd smoked the terrorists. They'd come out as the task force heroes, fading into the darkness like Batman with nobody knowing who had done the deed. Carly had been hung out to dry for disobeying CIA orders to help. Knuckles had pleaded to George Wolfe, the deputy director of the task force, and an old CIA hand. He'd made some calls and put Carly back into hero land. She'd never forgotten it. Knuckles smiled and said, "Yeah, sure." "You wouldn't tell your boss, but I'm pretty sure you spent some time after Lima trying to figure out who we were, did you?" She pursed her lips and said, "No, but I didn't look that hard. I don't need to know. Some things are compartmented for a reason. But it's still helping the United States. It's the same reason I helped Guy." She saw the look again and narrowed her eyes, now catching on as to why we weren't acting like this was a high school reunion. "You're not here just to bullshit, are you?" Knuckles said, "No, we're here to find Guy." "Why? What did he do?" Knuckles shook his head slowly, saying, "Carly, I can't tell you, but it's not good. I need to know what he did here, what you did for him. I saw her eyes widen, now realizing that blind allegiance in the name of friendship may not have been the best course of action. She said, Jesus, it's Lima all over again. I'm going to get barbecued for helping you guys. I said, no, no you're not. Because nobody can know that you did anything to help Guy. This isn't like Lima. There is no good coming of it. Chapter 34. Carly went from Knuckles to me, looking for a joke that wasn't there. She said, what's going on? What's Guy doing? I said, what did you help him with? She jerked her hands away from Knuckles and said, don't go prosecutor on me. What's he doing? Knuckles looked at me, the team leader. Not wanting to voice it out loud himself, he deferred to my judgment on what to say. Carly followed suit, looking me in the eye and saying, so you think Guy's over here exploiting the economic turmoil? He's in Greece using his government connections to make a windfall on the mess of the Eurozone fight? It was the least possible of a bad situation. She didn't believe it even as she said it. I saw the hope in her eyes, wanting it to be something as simple as fraud. I hesitated for a moment, then said, you know Guy. Would he do that? Her eyes on me, I saw the hardness come, the realization. She shook her head, saying, no, he's not someone who would exploit anything for personal gain. I nodded. She said, then what? I glanced at Knuckles, wondering how far to go. I decided to take a step back. All we need to know is what you did for him. We're trying to find him and don't have a handle. She took that in and said, don't have a handle? You can't even call him? He's your man. What's going on? She locked eyes with Knuckles and said, I deserve to know. I lost Decoy. Now I'm losing Guy. Tell me. Knuckles glanced at me for help. I decided not to sugarcoat it. Guy is off the reservation. He's hunting men and he's killing them. She took that in, going from me to Knuckles, skepticism on her face. She'd seen enough of the intelligence world to wonder if maybe Guy had done something sanctioned and was now being cut free with her helping to hang him. She paused at my words, considering, then said, he's killing innocents? I leaned forward. No, they aren't innocent. At least I don't think so, but they are innocent until proven guilty. He wasn't sent on this mission. He took it on his own, and he's killing people one by one. She looked at Knuckles and said, Guy wouldn't do that. He said, I know, it's complicated. He thinks he's in the right, but he's not. We want to stop it and need your help. She repeated, Guy wouldn't do that. He's not a murderer. I said, you don't know what he's capable of, but I do. I was chosen for this mission because I'm the one who knows what Guy is turning into. I'm the only one, and now I'm hunting him. She studied me, looking for the lie. There was none. She said, what do you want to know? Knuckles said, everything you do. And she told us, going through their meeting and his subterfuge about a mission, detailing her complicity in setting up a meeting with a member of the Greek underground, a man who could get him explosives and weapons. Towards the end, I saw her hands shaking. Sure, she just facilitated the extrajudicial killing of men she didn't even know. I stopped her and took her hand, saying, don't do this to yourself. You did what you thought was right. You trusted Guy, and that was right. You couldn't recognize the change. I looked at Knuckles and said, he didn't recognize it in me. Knuckles rocked his head, looking at the sky and thinking. He said, that's correct to a point. But you left the unit before you became Guy. I let a grim smile escape and said, yeah, I suppose that's true. I returned to Carly and said, look, you did nothing wrong. You used your judgment, and any other time it would have been correct. I need you to use it again. I need to find this man you turned him on to, Nikos. She nodded and said, I can do that, but if I do, Nikos is going to wonder what's going on. Why would I engineer two separate meetings? It makes no sense. He'll be waiting, and he'll be less than friendly. He's not a man to cross. I considered her words and said, yeah, okay. That's probably a bad idea, no meeting, yet. But give us everything you know about him. It might come in handy to find Guy. More importantly, he may contact you again. If he does, we need to know about it. Can you do that? Can you set him up for us if he calls? Knuckles' phone rang. He looked at the screen and said, Creed. He stood up and walked away. Carly let him leave and said, What do you mean, set him up? All I want to do is bring him home. I've known Guy longer than you. I've no desire to harm him, but this has to stop. It's going to cause repercussions to the national interests. He's not hunting wannabe jihadists. He's hunting government officials. No matter how much I might agree with the targets, he's in the wrong. She nodded slowly, then said, Maybe I can help if he calls again. I said, That's all I'm asking. Knuckles returned and said, We've got to go. Creed cracked the carrier IQ software. The good news is he managed to find the name registered with the phone. And we now own the handset. The bad news is Guy's left Athens. Where is he? Crete.
Chapter 35. Guy listened to the phone buzz its distinctive rhythm one more time, then threw his toothbrush into the sink and ran into the bedroom, pulling up the OneSpy application on his laptop. The target was on the move, the speed showing he was on foot, but Guy knew he wouldn't be walking for long. He'd rented a car for a reason, and Guy was sure he was linking up with that vehicle. This is it, the meeting. Guy packed his bag, one eye on the digital display. The dot was stationary for a minute, then began to move, much faster than before. On the road. Guy jogged downstairs, ignoring the elevator, then speed-walked past the front desk to the sidewalk outside. He reached the narrow lane in front of the hotel, a mess of traffic cones and yellow tape marking road construction. Behind it was a line of scooters, something that was ubiquitous around the island, so much so that the Heraklion Airport had a poster from the British consulate warning its citizens about getting drunk and wrecking them. Apparently something that occurred frequently enough for an ad campaign. After leaving the waitress at the restaurant, he'd debated getting a car and had settled on the scooter. Since there was no parking at the hotel, a rental wasn't responsive, as he'd have to have it delivered at a time he wanted to use it, then picked back up. Since he had no idea of a time, he'd opted for the ridiculous scooter, taking a risk that the target wasn't going to drive for hours. The only problem with it was they didn't take cash. He was forced to pay with his new credit card. It would be a trace someone could use. He'd paid cash for the hotel and cash for his plane tickets, but he knew he'd have to cross this line sooner or later. Couldn't be helped, and anyway, he'd had to present his passport for the plane tickets. If they had the card, it would be through the passport to begin with. He looked at his phone, the OneSpy app showing the blue dot moving out of the city on the E-75, the main east-west highway. A dangerous sign for his little steed. He wheeled the scooter around and set out, feeling like Austin Powers. Traveling at a blistering 55 kilometers an hour, being passed by all the cars on the road, and getting his face pelted by flying insects, he drove for 30 minutes before pulling to the side of the road to check his phone. The target had stopped at a small coastal enclave called Sisi. Guy did a quick search and saw it was known more for its beaches and expats than anything else. He pulled back onto the blacktop, continuing on. 20 minutes later, he was off the highway, taking a left towards the coast on a bumpy, potholed piece of asphalt. He held his phone in one hand, zoomed to maximum, entering the town and then weaving left and right. Eventually, he ended at an empty field, the phone beacon just beyond, inside some sort of house near the water. He parked and skulked through the tall grass of the field, kicking beer cans and bottles as he tried to remain quiet. He got closer and heard music, then laughter, He reached the front and saw a skull and crossbones pirate flag, two men on a balcony drinking. It was an expat bar called, appropriately enough, the Jolly Roger. He entered a gate and swung around the back, seeing the ocean and the light of tiki lamps surrounding an open deck. In the corner, under a neon sign, he recognized the neatly trimmed mustache of his target. Next to him was a young man of about 25, medium height, swarthy skin, and sporting a scraggly jihadi beard like he had the mange. Between them was the banker's bag. Guy took a seat in the corner away from the strands of lights crisscrossing the deck. He ordered a beer from the waitress, a Brit who attempted small talk. He answered in short, clipped sentences. Not mean, but definitely not looking for conversation. He waited until the beer had arrived and the waitress had given up on him before drawing his camera. He took the best photographs of the new man that he could, knowing the lighting would cause havoc with the image, then settled in, watching from across the deck, the light strings above swaying in the breeze, alternately illuminating then darkening the target table. Eventually, the banker's bag was unlocked and opened. Guy watched a manila folder, three fat envelopes, and an old-school flip phone passed across. His target said a few more things, then stood to leave. Guy felt the choice forced upon him. This was most definitely the meeting he'd heard about in Athens, and now his time for the mission was ticking down. The target had accomplished what he'd been sent to do and might be driving straight back to the boat to leave. But the new man was intriguing. He felt his target slipping from his grasp, but couldn't shake 20 years of operational deployments, of eliminating the threat for those who couldn't. And this meeting had all the hallmarks of something bad, something that should be reported. He let the target leave, feeling the sliver of darkness coil, demanding he follow. He stuck with the new man. After 20 minutes, the man stood, pulling a bill out of one of the envelopes, which gave Guy one answer of what had been passed. Money, and lots of it. Guy threw his own bills on the table and began to shadow the new man through the small town. Eventually, he entered a 3-story cinderblock hotel, a mom-and-pop establishment for the lower stratum of vacationers. Guy stayed outside and thought about his options, thought about the conflicting pressure of the killing he wanted to accomplish, juxtaposed against the problem in this hotel he wanted to solve. He decided maybe he could do both. He waited until he was sure the man was settled in his room, then got his own. He checked it out, surveying the dilapidated bathroom and worn bed. He pulled a wooden chair from a corner and setting it in the center of the room, thinking through his interrogation strategy. Satisfied, he picked up his phone and dialed another. When the woman answered, he said, "Hey, you ready to earn that money?" Chapter 36. Hyder smiled and said,
"Yes, I got the email. Very good. So you had no troubles? You'll be coming home tonight?"
Nasser said, "No, no troubles at all. He was right where you said he'd be. He has the money, the identification, and the phone. He'll be taking a ferry tomorrow." Hyder repeated, "So you'll leave tonight?" He heard a pause, then,
"No, I'd like to stay the night and leave first thing tomorrow, if that's okay."
"Why?"
"I have a woman, someone from Crete. She gave me her number, and she wants to meet at a hotel. I'm going there now."
"A hotel? And she's from Crete?" Understanding the question, Nasser said,
"Yes, she lives with her parents. All she asked was that I pay for the room."
Hyder looked at Khalid, his friend leaning forward with a scowl, wondering where the conversation was going. He said,
"No,
Nasser, there have been things that have happened. I want you home. I'm already there. The hotel was in the same town I met the Syrian. It's a town full of foreigners. She wants to get away from Heraklion.
Haider put some steel in his voice. A fake confidence easy to do over the phone.
Nasser, you do this. You make your own way home. I'm telling the yacht to leave tonight.
Haider heard the whining begin, Nasser always being the obsequious one.
You get what you want, no matter what you do. I never can. This is the one chance to act like I have a name. She thinks I'm royalty from Qatar. She thinks I'm like you.
Haider heard a car door slam and said,
Where are you right now?
I'm at the hotel, going to the room. I'll let you talk to her, if that'll make you feel better.
Haider looked at Khalid and saw anger. He said,
Don't do this. You don't understand what's going on. There's someone looking for us, looking for you, because of Afghanistan. A killer.
Haider heard a shuffling, the phone going from one ear to the next, then,
What are you talking about?
I don't want to say on the phone. Not here. Just get back. Now.
Haider heard a noise and said,
What are you doing?
Knocking on the door. I'll pass the phone to her. She's something you'd like to bed, I promise.
Haider started to protest, then heard Nasser say,
Who are you?
Khalid was stomping about the room, demanding answers. Haider held up a finger, waiting on Nasser to say something. He didn't. Through the connection, the voice as strong as if he'd been the one holding the handset, Haider heard, Hang up the fucking phone. Then nothing. Haider dropped his arm, incredulous, the cell phone hanging uselessly by his side.
Khalid said, What? What's going on? It's him. It's the killer.
Guy heard the knock and looked through the peephole, seeing his target and feeling a flush of vengeance, the dark coils in his soul triumphant. He stared further and saw he was on his cell phone, talking to someone. He backed up, thinking. He couldn't open the door with the jerk talking on the phone. It was a trace, a last vestige of the target's life. He was expecting a woman to open the door. And when it was Guy, he'd inevitably say something into the phone. Something that couldn't be hidden when he came up missing. He heard another knock, this one more insistent, and turned a small circle, cursing.
Let him go. Follow the man in the hotel. Do what's right.
He felt the pull, felt the draw from his past, where the rule of law dictated his life. He leaned into the eye hole and saw the face from his brother's armband, the face of the man who had caused the death of an entire Special Forces team. He leaned against the wall, his hands pressing his temples.
Do it. Don't do it. Do it. Don't do it.
The blackness twitched, uncoiling in his soul. He looked through the peephole again and saw the target begin to move away.
He's going to leave. This is it.
Unbidden, his hand went to the knob. Like a thing from another body, he saw his arm open the door. Saw the look of shock on the man's face. He said, Hang up the fucking phone. Chapter 37.
Khalid said, What do you mean? The killer? He's there right now?
Haider nodded, mute.
Are you saying he's killing Nasser as we speak?
Yes. No, I don't know. Nasser said he was meeting a female, then I heard another man tell him to hang up the phone. Then it disconnected.
Khalid said, Look into your heart. Was it the killer? Haider nodded hesitantly, then with more power.
Yes, it was him. He's tracking us.
He looked at Khalid and said,
"How did he know? How did he find Nasser?"
Khalid said, "He works for the United States. This isn't a lone gunman. We need to capture him, interrogate him, find out what he knows." On the verge of panic, thinking of his father, Haider said,
"How? We don't know anything about him. He seems to know everything about us."
Haider put his hands to his head and said,
"He's going to find out about the Syrian. He's going to learn our plans."
Khalid turned cold, clinical. "No, he won't. He will learn about the existence of the Syrian. In fact, he most likely already has. But you didn't tell Nasser what you told me after your meetings with the American Secretary of State. Nasser doesn't know anything of value, other than the Syrian exists. And we can use that against the American."
"How?"
"When he learns of the Syrian, the man will want to hunt him, to kill him. It's impossible for him not to. We use his own desire against him." Haider recoiled at the very notion, saying,
"Khalid, I can't do that. If anything happens to the Syrian, my father will disown me. I should call him, get his advice, let him know what has transpired."
He brought the phone back up, and Khalid placed a hand on his arm, stopping him. "Don't call your father. He will tell you to send the Syrian as planned, and then disown you anyway." Khalid chuckled and said, "Don't worry. It's not too bad. I've been dead to my father from birth." Haider ignored the comment.
"I have to call him. This is too big of a problem. The man has killed two of us, and now might destroy my father's plans. If it festers, my father might do more than just disown me."
Khalid said, "Give it a day. Contact Nikos and have him send some men to Crete. I'll go with them. The American has Nasser's phone, and I'm sure Nasser has given him whatever passwords went along with it. Send Nasser an email detailing a new meeting for the Syrian, someplace where he won't dare attack. Then call the Syrian and tell him to go there. The man will find him, and the Syrian will lead him straight to us, at a location we control." Haider wavered, and Khalid said, "Remember Ahmed. Remember Nasser. Your father doesn't care about them, but you do. We can avenge them." Khalid placed his hands on Haider's shoulders, facing him square. Haider saw the crazy leaking out of his eyes. A small tear when they were in Qatar. It had grown larger since Afghanistan, like a split in a bucket. Khalid said, "You are my friend. But if you do not do this, you won't have to worry about your father. I'll kill you myself." Guy returned from the small bathroom, carrying a rag damp with water. He walked to the man in the chair, taking his time, letting the dread build. Eyes rolling left and right, unable to turn his head, the man was sweating profusely. Using a roll of duct tape, Guy had strapped him to a chair like a mummy, both legs and arms cinched tight. He'd taken two broomsticks and run them up the back of the chair, strapping one behind each ear, then down the chair. His target was completely immobile, his shirt hitched high and his pants pulled down to his knees. Directly to the front of the chair was a small end table. On top of it were all of the possessions the man had on him. Wallet, smartphone, change, and a laser-cut key. Next to the key was a pair of pliers. Guy moved the table back a few feet, then squatted in front of the man and pulled out the rag he'd stuffed in the man's mouth. He said, "What's your name?" The man said nothing. Guy held up the rag and said, "Open your mouth back up. The man pursed his lips closed. Almost conversationally, Guy said, "You know the most sensitive parts of the human body? Your fingertips and your penis." He picked up the pliers and said, "Oh, and your tongue. But I can't use that because I need you to be able to speak. Now I'm going to start with your fingers, the first just to get you to open your mouth. Then once the rag is back in to muffle the screams, I'm going to apply some pressure so that you know what's going to happen. Then I'll start my questions. Some of them I already know the answer to, some I don't. It'll be up to you to figure out which ones to lie to me about. But if you make a mistake, the penalty will be enormous." The man began to cry. Inwardly, Guy felt the relief slip out, like a balloon losing air. This man was not nearly as hard as the one in Key West. After that episode, Guy had planned on each of his targets being die-hard fanatics. This man clearly was not. Showing nothing but malice, Guy said, "So you know, I have more than 10 questions. So eventually, if you don't answer correctly, we're going to reach little Peter there. After that, I'll have to get creative." The man closed his eyes and mumbled something. Guy thumped his forehead and said, "What was that?"
"Nasser. My name is Nasser."
"Good. Now that wasn't too hard, was it?" Nasser mumbled,
"No."
"Okay then, second question. When was the last time you were in Afghanistan?" Nasser looked confused at the track of the question, and Guy raised the pliers, gently placing the tip of Nasser's index finger between the jaws. Guy said, "I'm not even going to pretend I don't know the answer to that question." Nasser said,
2 months ago. It was the only time. I've never been there before that, I swear."
A strange mishmash of emotions flooded into Guy. Victory competing with sadness, competing with anger. He felt the urge to take Nasser's murdering life right then, the snake coiling for vengeance. But the meeting that had occurred earlier pulled at the back of his brain. A need to learn if this cell intended to kill again. A responsibility to the duty he'd sworn to uphold. And a yearning for absolution for what he was about to do. He changed tack to throw off his subject, turning to the table and pointing at the key with his free hand. "Tell me what this goes to." Whipped by the change in direction, Nasser stumbled for an answer, and Guy closed the pliers, shoving in the rag as soon as Nasser's mouth flew open. A tortured grunt came through the rag, and Nasser released his bladder. Guy leapt up, yanking the rag from his mouth. Without any humor, he said, "That's not going to stop anything from happening." Between sucking in great gouts of air, Nasser choked out,
"It's for a safe deposit box, a bank box."
The room reeking of urine, sweat, and the uniquely pungent smell of animal terror. Nasser staring at the pliers on his finger, waiting on the bite. Guy said, "Safe deposit box? At the Alpha Bank here?" Nasser tried to nod, the forehead moving a millimeter in its tape cocoon.
Yes, the Alpha Bank."
Before Guy could ask another question, Nasser's eyes flew open and he shouted,
No, not here, not the one here, the Alpha Bank in Athens, please, I didn't mean to lie."
Guy realized the man had broken. Nasser was now correcting himself without any pressure being applied. He was done. Guy set the key down and said, "Good, Nasser, very good, I believe you." Nasser sagged in relief, the tape alone holding him upright. Guy tapped his crushed finger, drawing a yelp of pain. Guy said, "Don't take my kindness for granted. We aren't done." Eyes wide, tears running down his face, Nasser waited. Guy said,
Tell me about this man you met today.
Chapter 38. We hit the runway of Heraklion Airport, and I immediately told Knuckles to call Creed, seeing if he'd gotten any more fidelity on the man we were hunting. Creed had managed to crack the carrier IQ of the phone, giving us a wealth of data, including its location. But he was still trying to find out the man behind the phone, or more precisely, the name of the man behind the phone. We needed that. Even in today's electronic world, an identity was paramount. It was something that could be hidden online, but was necessary in the real world, and the real world still mattered in a manhunt, at least for a few more years. Too many vendors required identification. Required some measure of proving who you were, from hotels to airlines to rental cars. And in foreign countries, that meant a passport. A U.S. driver's license wouldn't cut it. In the end, you just can't fake it when you're talking to a human. And if we could find that name, we could track Guy. We taxied to the FBO, away from the commercial terminal, and Brett stood up saying, "What do you want downloaded?" The aircraft we were in was a Gulfstream 650, a rock star bird like the once famous celebrities used to initiate unfortunate groupies into the Mile High Club, and was leased to Grolier Services through about 1,000 cutouts that eventually ended up at Blaisdell Consulting and the task force. As much as I would have loved to test out Jennifer's propensity to be a groupie, okay, I didn't say that, its true purpose was to infiltrate our weapons and equipment through customs, with everything hidden in secret panels throughout the aircraft. Brett was wanting to know what to break out, since the concealment was a little bit of a bitch to penetrate, with each category of equipment in its own little shell. I said, "Surveillance stuff only. Cameras, cell phone penetration, and beacons. I only want one suitcase. I don't want to walk out of here like we're tracking an army." "Weapons?" I considered, not liking the thought, but knowing it was necessary. Pistols, suppressed. Nick was sitting wide-eyed, listening to the conversation next to Jennifer. He'd taken that seat on purpose. I was sure because he knew her and she was friendly. He was still scared of me, which suited me just fine. He said, "Are we going to do an assault here, on Crete?" I said, "That'll all depend on him." "Don't freak out on me here, kid. You just point him out, I'll do the rest." Nick went from Knuckles to Jennifer to me. He said, "I'm not sure." I said, "Not sure of what? All I'm asking you to do is ID him for me. Jennifer will be with you. She'll work the kit. Don't make me regret bringing you here. I promise you won't get hurt." I saw him take the words as an insult, and I realized I'd misjudged his reticence. He said, "When I was in Ireland, you showed a desire to do good. A ferocious will to rescue Kylie. It's why I came to the task force. I'm just not sure this is good." I said, "Look, I'm sure you thought you'd be slaying terrorists left and right, but sometimes you follow orders, even if they're unpleasant. This doesn't make me happy any more than it does you, but you are doing good." "How? We're chasing an American. We're hunting a guy in the task force, someone I'm supposed to emulate. Someone I should look up to. Instead, I'm wondering if I'm going to kill him." I glanced at Jennifer passing the ball. She took it seamlessly. She said, "You talked about Pike as someone you trust. Someone who got you to join this organization because you saw something in him that you wanted to follow. So did I." I nodded, pleased with her using my leadership to get him to continue. Then she said, "But Pike wasn't always this way. When I met him, he was the sorriest human being I've ever seen. And I don't mean just because he was pathetic. He was worse than that. He was despicable." I started to spit out something to get her to shut up, and she held up her hand, silencing me. Nick looked surprised at the action, which really aggravated me. Before I could explode, Jennifer said, "I saw him slaughter two men with his bare hands in a psychotic rage. I ran from him because I saw a sociopath. Then he saved my life at great risk to his own. He was not that man, and neither is Guy." As serious as I've ever seen her, she said, "This is just like hunting terrorists, because you're going to save a life. Guy's life, and he deserves it. Pike picked you for the same reason you joined. He trusts you. And I've been here before. Let's bring Guy home. Nick looked uncertain, and I said, hey, this is a shitty mission all the way around. But I wouldn't have taken it if I didn't have a team to get it done. I chose you because of your judgment. Don't sell me short on the same thing. Knuckles came forward holding out the phone. He said, we got him. He's currently at a tourist attraction south of Heraklion, inland. Been there for a couple of hours. Name? Did they get his ID? Yeah, they think. They found digital links to some guy named Sean Parnell, and they think it's him. He's used a credit card to buy a ferry ticket and a moped here on Crete, and the name came into Greece on the timeline we have for Guy. Nothing on hotels, though. All I heard was the name, feeling a little sadness at what Guy had done. I said, Sean Parnell? Does that mean something? Yeah. It's him. I knew a guy named Parnell in Ranger Battalion. Second bat. No way is that a coincidence. So he's getting help from active duty guys? They give him a passport? You think this is a conspiracy? I shook my head. No. Parnell's dead. Killed in Iraq.
This ends Disc 5.